You have probably heard of the Big Bang Theory, but could you tell a quark from a lepton? Do you know what goes on inside a collider? Our first guest certainly does. Stephanie Majewski is an assistant professor of physics at the University of Oregon. She won an early career award from the Department of Energy for her work looking into the stuff, the tiny and often invisible stuff that makes up the universe. And that's what we'll talk about in this installment of Curious, Radio Meets Research, our visits with U of O people about their work. Hi, Dr. Majewski.
Hello, how are you this morning?
Good, good to have you here. Let's start with dark matter. It's always fun to talk about this because it's one of those things where it's, for most of us, it seems like this is kind of hard to prove. I mean, first of all, what is it and are we sure it's there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So basically, the way that we can think about dark matter is that our galaxy, as we know it, couldn't exist based on what we see. We see all of these visible things like stars and the gas in the galaxy. And based on all of that visible stuff, the galaxy as we know it could not hold itself together through just gravity. It's not strong enough to hold together all of those visible things. So in fact, we have something called dark matter, which is a proposed solution to this issue, to the fact that the galaxy would just break apart because it's spinning so quickly. And so the hypothesis is that there's this tiny particle, dark matter, or maybe it's a set of particles that permeates our galaxy and only interacts gravitationally. That means we can't see it. It doesn't give off any visible signal to us. The only way we know that it's there is indirectly.
So dark matter is something like, like a matrix or a webbing holding all the other stuff together?
I think you can think of it more as a particle, but yeah, that particle is interacting through gravity with all of the visible particles, and so it is kind of like a webbing inside the galaxy as far as holding it together, but it's through gravity.
So what kinds of experiments have been undertaken to help us know more about dark matter?
Right. So there's a few different options that you can have when you're thinking about how the heck do we prove that this is a particle, that what we think it is. So one is that we can basically put a detector on the Earth underground in a deep mine, and we can look for it directly. We just wait for something to hit our detector because we know that dark matter is sort of hanging out in the galaxy, and we just put a detector there and wait for it to hit. Nothing has shown up there yet. The other way that we can look for it, since we think it's a particle, is that we can try to produce it. And so that's the experiment that I work on over at the Large Hadron Collider.
All right, so the people have heard of the Large Hadron Collider and other atom smashers. What goes on inside these machines?
Yeah, so you can think about the Large Hadron Collider. We call it a big particle accelerator, but you can think about it as a microscope. So we use this to basically accelerate these very tiny particles together, smash them together, and then break them apart to see what might come out. And in fact, we're hoping that the result of one of those collisions, or many of those collisions, in fact, will give us some evidence that for dark matter and how it connects to the standard model of the standard model of particle physics.
So by smashing things together, are you making smaller particles that might not have already existed?
Potentially. I mean, they already exist, but we're making them, sort of making them inside our experiment.
Okay. So it's an interesting kind of dichotomy because you're looking at trying to look at some of the smallest things in the universe and yet trying to understand the huge picture of what the universe is.
Yes. It's amazing. It's the biggest questions and the smallest questions altogether.
Stephanie Majewski is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's an assistant professor of physics at the University of Oregon. We're talking about particle physics and quarks, leptons, dark matter, supersymmetry we haven't gotten to yet. All kinds of stuff to talk about here. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's talk about supersymmetry. What is that?
Right. So supersymmetry actually might help us explain dark matter. So we're pretty sure that dark matter is a particle, but we don't know how it relates to the particles that we know about, stuff like the protons and the electrons that we're very familiar with. We're not sure how dark matter connects to those particles. So in fact, supersymmetry is a theoretical idea that can connect dark matter to the particles that we know about. And it provides, basically, for all of the particles that we know about, it gives another partner particle to those particles. So, for example, the electron, it has a supersymmetric partner that's theorized called the selectron. And so through this, we basically have this mirror symmetry between the particles that we know about and these supersymmetric partners. And we believe that dark matter might be one of those supersymmetric partners.
And so do you also have to use an accelerator to look for it?
Yes, exactly. So in fact, that's in particular what I'm looking for. The heaviest particle that we know about is called the top quark, and it was actually discovered at Fermilab outside of Chicago in the 90s at a particle accelerator there. So I'm in particular studying the top quark, and if it could potentially have a supersymmetric partner that we would call the stop, because we put this S in front of all of the particle names when we for their supersymmetric particle partners. And so I'm looking for the stop that might decay to the top quark and dark matter. And that's in particular what I'm looking for at the Large Hadron Collider.
When I looked at your material on the web, I was still trying to figure out the stop part of this. So this is sort of like the opposite of the top quark, the stop quark or something?
Yeah, exactly. It's the supersymmetric opposite. Exactly.
Okay. All right. So when you're working at the Large Hadron Collider, there's something else that we haven't talked about yet called the ATLAS detector.
Yes.
What does that do?
Yeah. So that's kind of like the eye of our microscope. It's a big camera that's around the collision point. So the particles collide inside the Large Hadron Collider. We've built the ATLAS detector all around that collision point so that we can take a picture of exactly what comes out when these particles collide. And in fact, we take 100 million pictures per second of the particle collision.
So you had to develop a super complicated piece of machinery to be able to look at what the other super complicated piece of machinery is doing?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Wow. How do you keep all this stuff straight in your head? And obviously you have an aptitude for it. You've been doing this for years now.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's interesting because I have a lot of undergraduates at the University of Oregon who work with me on this research, and I can tell that it's tough for them at first, but they get so into it that it's almost like a game, you know, you want to learn all of the different pieces and all of the different lingo so that you can communicate.
How do you set up experiments at the Large Hadron Collider? It is in Switzerland, and so who decides who gets in and for how long?
Right. So, in fact, there's about 5,000 collaborators on the ATLAS experiment, and we all get to use all of the data. And, in fact, we can even use it here at Oregon. We just transfer the data over, and we can analyze it here on local machines at Oregon. So that part is really streamlined very nicely. So, in fact, the Large Hadron Collider, when it's running 24/7. And it's just taking, our experiment is taking data all the time. And what we're looking for are very rare events in that data set. So things that happen really not very often, and we're trying to pull them out from this massive amount of data that we're collecting.
Is there a schedule for it? I mean, does everybody connected to the LHC, like you know, they're going to be doing this, and this on Thursday at, 3 p.m., and so we'll be looking for the data sometime early Friday or something?
Yeah, it's basically continuous throughout. They run from about March through October usually, and in fact, you can monitor it online. They have a website that's open to the public where you can just watch how the accelerator is doing right now.
So, can you give an example of an experiment that the U of O might have initiated at the LHC?
So we're all working on the ATLAS experiment, and in particular, the piece of the experiment that we're particularly involved in is this picture-taking aspect. So which pictures, which events might be interesting for us to record? And we want to make sure that we keep all of the interesting ones and that we only throw away the boring ones that we think we know what they are. So the low energy, not very interesting, not very supersymmetric-like events, we leave those for another day. But in fact, we work very hard on this picture-taking aspect and keeping all of the interesting events for the whole experiment, in fact.
So what so far has shown up in the pictures that might make you go, I think we're onto something here?
Well, in fact, about 4 years ago, we discovered the Higgs boson, for example. And so that was a brand new particle that no one had ever seen before. It had been proposed in about 50 years ago, and we finally discovered it at the Large Hadron Collider in the ATLAS experiment about 4 years ago.
Okay, so for the folks who have not kept up with the news, me included, the Higgs boson is important. Why?
So this particle, in fact, is very, it was kind of the last piece of the standard model of particle physics. So the standard model, which I mentioned before, but it's basically a theory that describes how all of the particles that we know about interact with each other. And it's this really elegant, beautiful theory that's really detailed and well proven. And the last piece of this was to discover this particle called the Higgs boson, which we thought was going to be... We knew it was there, but it was so rare, it was so difficult to find. In fact, they tried to find it at Fermilab in the 90s and beyond, And in fact, it took a larger machine, the Large Hadron Collider, to actually discover it. And so we were able to discover it finally 4 years ago. And this particle is very special because it basically tells all of the other particles how strongly they interact with the Higgs boson determines what their mass is or how heavy they are.
So essentially you found a missing link. I mean, you figured out that there was a set and you were missing one thing in the set.
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
So it's hugely exciting and, in fact, won the Nobel Prize for that, the discovery of that particle. The proposal of the particle was by Peter Higgs and Francois Englert, and they won the Nobel Prize for it in 2013.
We're talking to Stephanie Majewski, an assistant professor of physics at the University of Oregon, about particle physics and all the fun things she does. This is part of our regular visit with researchers at the University of Oregon in our Curious segment. Jamie in Medford wants to know what your take on antimatter is.
Yeah, so one thing that people don't necessarily know because it's been so popularized, antimatter is a perfectly regular thing. It exists. We have antiparticles that for all of our set of particles. It's actually very similar to the supersymmetric partners. In fact, you can think of the supersymmetric theory as being inspired in a way by the matter-antimatter symmetry. So every particle that we know about has an antimatter particle, and there are, in fact, dedicated experiments at CERN where they look at basically how groups of these antimatter particles behave in gravity and that sort of thing. So antimatter is a perfectly standard thing, and we know it exists, and we produce it all the time at the Large Hadron Collider.
Just in the time of your attachment to physics, and looks like you were still an undergraduate around the turn of the century, has knowledge advanced greatly then? I mean, do we understand better how the universe got to be what it is today?
Yes, but we've also uncovered bigger questions. For example, dark matter has been, we've uncovered this question when we're starting to figure out how to tackle it. But in fact, we know that dark matter makes up about 27% of the universe, but we don't really know much about it yet, besides that we think it's a particle. So it's been a really exciting time to be a physicist because we've had some really satisfying moments, like the discovery of the Higgs boson, but then we still have these big open questions, like what the heck is 27% of our universe?
So you get to these like, yay, we discovered this great thing, but then, oh wait, this now raises more questions that we have to answer.
Exactly, which keeps us going. That's the fun part.
I can imagine. You had a physics slam on campus last year, I noticed, and it looks like the U of O pioneered the concept in 2011. What happens at those?
Right. So it's kind of like, it was inspired kind of like a poetry slam. In fact, they had one, back a few years up, even before I arrived. This one, we had a few faculty in the physics department get up on stage. We had a few hundred people in an auditorium, and we basically spent 10 minutes talking about our research to the general public. It was a great event. Really exciting. We made it a little bit of a competition between the faculty. It was really great.
Did anybody get prizes for it or anything?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was annoyed because Scott Fisher beat me. I was very disappointed.
Darn you, Fisher. when I want to look at the parts that go on at the Large Hadron Collider, the thing is, what, a 17-mile circumference ring?
That's right, exactly.
Under Switzerland. The magnets, the cooling. I mean, there are lots of working parts on the LHC. It seems like there's lots that can go wrong.
That's right. And in fact, so the magnets themselves are insanely complicated. There's 1,500 of these huge superconducting magnets around the ring. About a third of those were actually built in the U.S. And provided to the Large Hadron Collider. And there are definitely things that can go wrong. For example, back in April, we had just started taking data for the year. The machine was sort of warming up again, getting ready to go to kind of produce proton collisions at the highest energies and at the highest luminosities. And, in fact, a little weasel, got into a transformer and chewed it and blew the transformer, and it brought down the Large Hadron Collider for about a week.
Oh, wow. The work of mighty physicists undone by weasels.
Exactly. That's this little tiny weasel.
That's not why the LHC was shut down for like 2 years, is it?
No, it was not. That one was not because of the weasel. That was actually an issue with the interconnects between two of the superconducting magnets, which has since been fixed. So we're running smoothly now.
Put people's minds at ease. Are you doing anything in the Large Hadron Collider that could blow up the world or anything?
No, not at all. In fact, even though it seems like large energies for us, for humans. In fact, in the cosmos, there are much higher energy collisions happening all the time. In fact, we are getting irradiated all the time. Little cosmic rays are hitting our atmosphere of the Earth all the time at higher energies than what we're able to do with the Large Hadron Collider. So in fact, we're just mimicking the collisions of the universe, and actually our energies are kind of small compared to the cosmic scale.
Okay, so things are going on outside our atmosphere that more violent than what you're saying than what goes on inside the collider.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, aside from knowing more about the universe, are there practical applications in particle physics? I mean, you know, will coffee stay hotter or tires don't wear out as fast or anything like that?
Well, the great thing about fundamental research is that we're not exactly sure what's going to come out of it. One of the side benefits that came out of the research at CERN and exchanging vast amounts of data across the ocean is actually the World Wide Web. In fact, the first website was developed at CERN, and there was a connection between the West Coast, United States, and CERN to transfer data back and forth, because we had these large data sets that we needed to get back and forth. And before that, people were mailing tapes back and forth with data on them. So in fact, this was an interesting spinoff that was totally unforeseen that grew into the internet as we know it today. That's this huge, amazing thing, but it grew out of particle physics, in fact. Another example that I can mention is that the discovery of the electron, when it was first discovered, was kind of like, okay, so what? We've discovered this particle. We don't know what it's going to do for us. And now we have computers, we have electricity and lights, we have all of these things that come out of this little tiny particle discovery. Once we can figure out how to harness that particle and use it for us, we can, you know, the sky's the limit as far as what we're able to imagine that we could do with this particle.
You make it sound very fun. It clearly gets you out of bed in the morning. Stephanie Wojcicki has been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, assistant professor of physics at the University of Oregon and winner of an early career award from the Department of Energy, joining us for our regular segment called Curious, Radio Meets Research. Stephanie, thanks for joining us today in the Exchange.
Thank you very much.